Hi, this is the sixth class on December 5th, and we are in Derech Hashem, chapter 3, section 1, chapter 3. We're up to paragraph 9. Let's start with a drop of review. So we finished off last week talking about I'm just going to read the last part of that paragraph and expand on that just a drop. The effort required to earn perfection was therefore doubled. Man must first bring both himself and the world back to the state in which they existed before the first sin. Only then can he raise himself from that state to his destined level of perfection. So one thing I think I didn't mention last week is that is the definition of tikkun olam. Did I talk about that at all? Do you remember, either of you?
No, I wasn't.
Okay.
I was not able to play back.
So when we talk about tikkun olam, it's very important to have a handle on what that concept actually is. It's important as a makarvot to understand that in Reform and conservative tradition, if you could call it that, in Reform and conservative understandings or word usage, let's say, they use the word tikkun olam very differently than we do according to our philosophic understanding. And I would say our philosophic understanding is even different than the way it's used in the Orthodox world. So I'll try to draw distinctions between them, but let's just start with, so Reform and conservative basically see tikkun olam as social justice or social action projects. And sometimes not social action, it might just be, you know, a positive project, some kind of, could even be, let's say, cleaning up a cemetery or working in a soup kitchen on Thanksgiving, feeding the homeless, or collecting food for a soup kitchen, something like that. Those would be considered in Reform and conservative tikkun olam projects, and they call them projects, and they even call them TO projects sometimes. It really is a part of the system. So, but that's not, those are positive things to do, but that's not tikkun olam. So tikkun olam really means fixing that which is broken in the world. So we spent a long time describing what the world was like before that first sin, and that's what was broken. So there's a concept of shvirat hakelim, which the Ramchal is not discussing here, really. I'm not sure where that concept is referenced, but we're aware of that concept, of the kelim that were holding the initial light. You know, when there was, I think we talked about tzimtzum a little bit, but when God contracted God's self in order to create the world inside God's space. Hi, who just joined us?
Hi, Siri Garfinkel.
Oh, hi, how are you? Welcome. Okay. We're just starting with a review.
Super.
So when God contracted God's self in order to put the world inside of it, that was a tzimtzum. And then inside that vacuum that was created by God's contraction, a thread of light was spun. And that thread of light, and this is one of those quote-unquote whatever that means statements, because who knows what this means, but this is what the Kabbalists say. A thread of light was spun in that vacuum, and then that thread of light was filtered through the spherot in order to manifest in this lower world that we inhabit. So there were some kalim that were created also that held that initial light, some of that initial light that's not the light that we recognize in this world. One of the things, I can't say I picked up the sensitivity, but just picked up on the sensitivity. When I used to be a closer talmidah of Tehila Yeager, I used to drive her to her shiur in Long Beach. She doesn't drive. So I'd drive to Far Rockaway, pick her up, and drive her to Long Beach. She'd give a shiur in Long Beach, and I'd drive her home. And that was my effort at that time to be mishamesh, a talmid chacham, mishamesh at talmidah chachama. And I got to spend time in her house and talk to her every week that way. So she spoke to her children in Hebrew. She speaks to her children in Hebrew, I imagine, still. And at that time, she had babies who were still learning how to talk. And she told me that it was so frustrating for her to point to a light fixture, because it's one of the first things that the babies point to. You know, and moms usually say, that's a light. Do you see the light? And she'd say, I don't know what to say. I can't call that or. That's not what or is. Or is much more sophisticated than that. It's a much greater concept. And I certainly don't want to call it chashmal, because that's maybe the name of a shade, and I don't want to use that either. And So she was, you know, I just remember her thinking about, like, what word should she use to refer to the light that's in this world when she knew that the concept of aura was something much greater. I think she probably had to use the word aura since that's modern Hebrew, but anyway, so there were kalim that held that aura at that time. And those kalim, those vessels were broken, in addition to many other facets of the world that were broken with that first transgression. So the phrase tikkun olam actually refers to this. We're just doing a review for those of you who just joined us in the end of paragraph 8. So it refers to this, that we have to bring the world back to where it was before that first sin. And then after we pass that, we can then strive for the ultimate perfection that we're destined for, Bezrat Hashem. So that's what Tikkun Olam is, fixing all the broken parts of the world. And I think it filtered down into reform and conservative usage for Tikkun Olam projects, just in that it's good things to do. So Tikkun Olam really is affected by doing positive things, doing mitzvot and chesed, and perfecting ourselves to the best of our ability, and then that perfects the world. So the dual job of the Jew is to perfect self and perfect the world. And the way that that's done, it's a symbiotic relationship between perfecting self and perfecting the world. We perfect ourselves through perfecting the world, and we perfect the world through perfecting ourselves. So it goes back and forth. But that is the basic way to use Tikkun Olam properly, is in reference to bringing, restoring the world back to the pre-sin state. That's what Tikkun Olam is. Any questions on that before we continue?
No.
Okay, yeah? Did somebody want to ask? Okay. So let's go forward then into paragraph 9. Okay, so now we know that there's a double effort required, that the effort of fixing the world and then moving ahead. But in addition to that, paragraph 9, justice decreed that neither man nor the world would ever be able to rise to perfection while still in their current fallen state. So this is what brings us back to that Pirkei Avot again and again. Lo alecha hamlacha ligmor, v'lo ata ben charin lehibatel mimena. It's not upon us to finish the job, and neither are we free to desist from attempting. Because we just saw that in 8, that our job is to fix the world and restore it to its perfected state before, to its potential state before the first sin, and then bring it to perfection. And now 9 is telling us right away it's not possible for that to happen while we're in this fallen state, that the transformation that was affected by that first sin was so devastating that it's not possible to use what's left of who we are and what this world is to bring it back, to restore it to its initial state. So because they remain in this spoiled, non-ideal condition, and evil in the meantime has increased, both must go through a stage of destruction before either can arrive at perfection. Man must therefore die, and everything else that was corrupted with him must also perish, which means this whole world. So the world has to go, and each individual man has to go and be separated we'll talk about that. The world has to perish first, to go through a period of destruction and then reconstruction in order to achieve what we might have achieved first with just refraining from eating that fruit of the tree. The soul cannot purify the body until the body dies and deteriorates and a new structure is composed that the soul can then enter and purify. The entire world must likewise be destroyed and cease to exist in its present form and must then be renewed in a new state worthy of perfection. It was therefore decreed that man should die and then be brought back to life. This is the concept of Tchiyat HaMitim, or Tchiyat HaMesim, depending on how you pronounce things. The entire world must similarly be destroyed and then renewed. This is the meaning of what our sages taught. 6,000 years will the world exist, and for 1,000 it will be desolate. And at the end of this 1,000 years, God will again renew his world. So that's the Gemara. I'm not equipped to learn Gemara, or really understand it more deeply than just having a piece shared here. So it's not something that I looked up, learned, or really fully understand. But I think there are some, even though the Gemara does say that, I think there are some questions if we're going to have 1,000 desolate years or not, or if we'll just transition into Yemot HaMashiach is not the perfected time, so I think Yemot HaMashiach comes before. But it's a good question where exactly Mashiach fits into this whole scene, that there's the 6,000 years and then the 1,000 years of desolation and then a renewal of the world. So so I can't really tell you what it's supposed to exactly be like. And I'm pretty sure, I've been through this book a few times, but I'm pretty sure he doesn't say the exact procedure for when Mashiach comes in Tchiyat HaMetim, because we do put those things together. They are related. I'm just trying to think. And so what that 1,000 years means, I think I'm going to have to ask somebody about that and get back to you about that, where that 1,000 years of desolation comes in. But let's just talk for a minute about the 6,000 years. So there is a concept that each one of the 1,000 years, six of them, corresponds to one of the days of creation, the 6 days of creation. And so if we are in 5772 right now, which we know that number is not exact. I don't know if you're aware, but we basically are counting pretty close, but there was some fudging of the numbers of the years so that we wouldn't be able to calculate the end, so that there wouldn't be disappointment if people don't understand the dates clearly. So while we are counting 5772 right now from creation of Adam with the soul, right, because we don't know what those 6 days were really, if they were long, if they were short, if they were 24 hours, if they weren't, there's all kinds of different theories on that. But the 5772 that we count is from when Adam got his soul. So even though that's our count and that's where we hold today, we should just know that there was some intentional mixing up of the numbers. So there's 100, 150 years, something like that. That's just not clear exactly where we're holding. And that's so that we can't calculate the end, because it really is supposed to be that by the year 6,000, Mashiach should come. And hopefully we could make that happen sooner. But there is an end date that if we're not Zoha to make it ourselves a little sooner, there is a final time that Mashiach is coming, ready or not. So that we won't be able to calculate that properly, it's not exactly 5772. Nevertheless, we are close to 5772, which means that if you take each 1,000 years and match it up with a day, so the millennium that we're in currently is the sixth millennium. So we're in the end of somewhere close to the end of the sixth millennium. 772, right, 5772, so we're about approximately three quarters of the way to the end of the sixth millennium. So the sixth day is Friday. The sixth millennium then is like Friday. Friday's Erev Shabbos. So Erev Shabbos is a day when you're preparing for Shabbos. And the time, the way time works on a Friday is it starts out slower, let's say Thursday night. You might do something to prepare for Shabbos. Friday morning, you get up, you have breakfast, you're cooking, whatever you're doing. But by lunchtime, not everybody sits to eat lunch on a Friday because things get a little speedier and people don't always have time to sit down and have lunch, eat something on the go, whatever you're cooking. And especially these winter Shabboses, things get faster and faster and faster and faster. Even in the summer, because we may take a little time in the morning, but things get faster and more hectic as we get closer and closer to candle lighting, and things really speed up until it's Shabbos. So we see that parallel happening right now in this sixth millennium, where time is speeding up, and it's getting faster and faster and faster and faster, because right now it's Erev Mashiach. And I think all of us feel that time is getting faster. And it's something that is different than how our parents felt at our age, that really the days are spinning by faster and time is going faster and the weeks feel shorter and the years pass quickly. You just turn around, and I mean, I feel like it was just, for sure it was just Rosh Hashanah, but it was almost just Pesach. And now it's going to be Hanukkah tomorrow, so practically tomorrow. So time is going faster, and that's because it's Erev Shabbos. Things are speeding up. It's late Shabbos afternoon right now, Erev Mashiach, and things are speeding up. So if we understand that Mashiach really is right around the corner, Erev Shabbos, so that makes a difference in our understanding of time and also our understanding of what we need to be doing to get ready. And also parenthetically, I'm sure many of you experienced in different communities that there is an increase in gerus right now in conversion in people seeking to join the Jewish people because it is the end. Conversion will not be a possibility after Mashiach comes. But until Mashiach comes, it's still possible. I was working with a whole family that was converting, and I was close with the wife, and she was so nervous about the whole thing. I mean, she was so excited. She wanted to be Jewish so badly, and she spent years studying, and she was already dressing the part and covering her hair in long sleeves and long skirts and you know, making brachot and really working hard and learning regularly. But she was so frustrated that the whole process took so long. And in Denver particularly, it takes a very long time. Everywhere it takes a long time, but Denver doesn't have its own conversion Beit Din. You have to go to another city or import a Beit Din here for it. So it takes a little bit longer in Denver than some other cities. And she was worried about it. And I tried to reassure her a little bit. She was already married. She already had kids. They were already in Jewish schools. You know, like what was her rush, really? And she told me so earnestly that she was afraid that Mashiach is going to come really soon and she wouldn't be able to. You know, the cutoff point is when Mashiach comes, and she knew that, and that was the deadline, and she was nervous that she wouldn't make the cut. So anyway, there she did make the cut. She's Jewish now. But there is, we do see more and more people coming to convert today at the end of days, because there is the concept that all nations are supposed to come tachat kanfei Shechina, and if the nations themselves don't choose to, then individuals from nations around the world will. So that is a way to bring the energy of each nation into the Jewish people, into Hashem's plan. Okay, so then there's going to be a renewal of the world. Let's go to paragraph 10. Any questions up to this point? Please feel free to interrupt me at any point. Okay, I'm going to continue then. Paragraph 10. The true time. Pardon?
Hello. Sorry, it's Shani. I have a quick question.
Great.
Maybe it's not quick. Could it be possible that all of the days of creation or that the referral to some form of Tchiyas HaMeisim or dying and bringing the world back could have been in like Dor HaMabo or Dor, you know, or any other period, and so meaning not with Tchiyas HaMeisim, but that referral that he's talking about, that in order to renew the soul, to make them renewable.
I don't think so. That's not my understanding that it was then, because the understanding is that it has to go through that in order for the world to be renewed, the world has to go through a period of destruction. But I'm really glad you asked that, because I forgot to bring out this concept, which I flagged for myself to bring out. So this is the version of Derech Hashem that I'm using is the one called Pathways to the Way of God. And it has Avraham Yaakov Katz's commentary to Derech Hashem in it. It's out of print. Sometimes you can find it used, but that's the copy that I'm using. So I want to read his footnote here on this. So he says, this concept of destruction of the world can be understood to refer to spiritual destruction, that the ideas and ideals which form the history of human thought will rise and fall and be replaced by changing fashions of ideologies and philosophical systems, and that each in turn will be proven wrong and will collapse into oblivion, and that the world of human philosophical searching based on fallible premises will thus be destroyed. So that, to me, is a little bit comforting as a thought, that that the destruction of the world might not be a physical destruction of the world. Destruction of people will be. Excuse me. People have to die. And we'll go further into that in just a minute. But that the world itself, the destruction of the world, may be a philosophical, ideological destruction. That the, in a way, the neshama of the world, the way the world breathes, in terms of the way it thinks, will rise and fall and be destroyed. And we see that happening around us right now, with different ideas coming about and different ideas rising and falling. Certainly, we see that in the last century with communism, and I guess socialism wasn't completely hasn't completely fallen, especially with the president that we have now. But it's still kind of an ideal. But there are ideas rising and falling, and I think we're going to see that with Islam also. And I think Islam is going to help us. I think the way the Muslims right now are trying to fight the West through the court system, through demanding rights and establishing rights, will push the West into examining its ideals at some point, or else its ideals will fall like they are in Europe. So, like, for instance, there was just an editorial in the Wall Street Journal, or the New York Times, one of the two, I think it was the Wall Street Journal today, that talked about that there's a world, I forgot what it's called, but something like the World Islamic Council, something like that, is trying to create legislation, international legislation, that it's forbidden to, for anybody to say anything negative about Muslims or Islam. And they want that to be the, not just the law in each land, so that there are different people who are working on it, let's say CARE, for instance, in this country, in the United States, since we have Canadian listeners, in the United States is trying to push for that in this country, but also in the international courts, they're trying to push for anti-blasphemous legislation worldwide. So they really are using the court. They understand that that there are a few different ways to win the fight. If their goal is a civilizational takeover, then they can do it by violence, or they could do it by legislation. So right now they're trying a combination, but they are trying to use the system of the country inside the system to take over ideologically. And we see some success in Europe. So I think the success of the push of the Muslims and the Muslim ideology is going to either cause some Western countries to become non-Western anymore, and I don't mean necessarily Muslim, but at least not Western, not holding those values, or it will cause them to re-embrace with strength their Western ideas and push back. But I think that there is going to be, you know, a rising and falling of ideas and ideals, and that could be one way that the world itself is destroyed, hopefully not physically. Okay, does that answer that question at all, Shani?
All right, yeah, that's good. It's good because it doesn't make sense, because also I think there would have been total destruction, right? There wouldn't have been a Noach left if it were in terms of the Mabel, because it wasn't total destruction. It was like, here's the glimmer of life.
Right, it wasn't total destruction. It's interesting to think about that model as a mikveh, when you teach about mikveh, that the world was dipped into a mikveh, and that water is a primal thing. You know, nowhere in the creation psukim does it discuss the creation of water. Water was there already. So water was divided, but it was there already. There's never like a vayihi mayim anywhere. So water, it's understood that water is there before the creation of the world, or certainly before the Torah narrative begins. And that's one reason why mikvah is transformational as an experience, even if you don't feel it necessarily, but that it is a transformational body, because you are tapping into pre-world water. And that's what allows one to go back to their primal existence and come back out as if born again. So the world also at that time did need to go through a destruction, but it needed to be immersed in a mikveh to touch to bring it back to its pre-existence so that it could come out born again. So the world wasn't utterly destroyed, but dipped in a mikvah so that it could be made tohor, hopefully, and start again. I just read a fascinating article. Pardon?
Is there critique or criticism on where water came from, that it existed alongside Hashem forever and ever?
It couldn't exist alongside Hashem forever and ever, because there is only one imperative existence, one eternal existence, and that's God. Only Hashem is forever and ever. So water has to be a creation. But it seems that it's much... Pardon?
Why would Hashem choose to leave it out? Meaning, leave its creation out. Why does, like, meaning, does that just have to give more rise to the need for more Amunah?
I think it's because water is a force that can bring you in touch with... I think water was created to be a force that can bring you in touch with who you were before you were created. That's basically, I mean, that's what Ari Kaplan discusses in his book, Waters of Eden, is that water was something that existed before the world was created. So it's a creation, but it existed before the world was created. It needed to exist, sort of like tshuva had to be created before we were given a mitzvah. So before we were given a mitzvah, it's interesting, if you look at, in the book, Waters of Eden, Ari Kaplan explains this, but he says, why do we have the psukim in the Chumash where it says, he created Adam, put him in the garden, and then he gives them the mitzvah, eat from the whole garden, eat, eat from that tree, don't eat, right? But there's four psukim in between where it says, he creates the garden, puts him in the garden, and then there's a river that comes from the east and explains these four rivers, where they go, what they're named, and then he gives them the mitzvah, don't eat of all the other things, eat, and from that one, don't eat. Right? So you have to say, why are the rivers there in the narrative? It messes up the narrative. It doesn't belong. It doesn't add to the story. It doesn't add to the flow of understanding of what's going on. I mean, it should be that you have the garden, you have the person, you have the trees, and you have the mitzvah. But what do you need the rivers for? So he explains that the concept of those waters had to be in place, a process, a physical way to get back to where you need to be, to restore yourself, had to be in place before the possibility of error was offered. Because that's what the first mitzvah was, is the possibility to bring oneself to perfection or the opposite. So before that could happen, the waters had to be there in place, ready for tshuva, and the concept of tshuva had to be there, ready for use, so that engaging in the sin wouldn't bring total and ultimate destruction, but rather there's a process to return. So the waters have to be there before the world, but they're still a creation. Now, if you email me, or maybe I'll just send it out to everybody, somebody sent me this fascinating article. Scientists discover the oldest, largest body of water in existence in space. So I'll just read the first sentence. Around a black hole about 12 billion light years away, there's an almost unimaginable vapor cloud of water enough to supply an entire planet's worth of water for every person on Earth 20,000 times over. So that is an unimaginable quantity of water. It's enough water to make every star in our, not that you can make stars into planets, but every star in our galaxy, if it was a planet, it would be enough to supply it with enough water to be like Earth, 13 trillion times each. It's an incredible amount of water. So the Rebbetzin that sent me this article said this just gives new meaning to the upper waters and the lower waters. This isn't water that we were even aware of, 30 years ago. It's recently discovered that there's lots of water in space. But, as short as 30 years ago, people thought of space as being a desert, that there was no water there at all. So anyway, there's plenty of water in space. There is a division of the waters, but water was created before the Torah narrative begins. Okay, that being said, let's go to paragraph 10. Let's see. Yeah. The true time and place of reward will therefore be after the resurrection in this renewed world. Man will then enjoy his reward with both the body and soul. The body will be purified by the soul and will therefore also be in a proper state to enjoy that good. So it's not just that the soul will be separated. We said before that the definition of death is the separation of body and soul, each going to their places, right? That's death. And then the resurrection will be when body goes back into, when soul goes back into body. So we'll discuss that in just a minute, what happens there. But the body will be purified by the soul. The body will be very different than the body that we inhabit right now. So let's just look for a second. Let me check here. Okay. I just want to see where I should go into a certain concept. I think I'll wait till 11. So let's just go through 10 quickly. Okay, the body will be purified by the soul and will... and the body then will also be in the proper state to enjoy the good. So it's not just soul alone in the ultimate existence. People will not all be equal at this time of reward. So meaning, of course, they're not even equal today, but we look equal. You can't really tell who's on a higher level than somebody else by looking at somebody. They will attain different levels depending on their work to attain perfection in this world of effort and striving. This will determine how much the soul can radiate and thus purify and enlighten the body so that both of them can gain excellence and elevation. This, in turn, will delimit how worthy they are of bringing themselves close to God, basking in his light and enjoying his true good. So we said in the last chapter, in chapter 2, purpose of creation, that the whole point is for God to be able to give God's good, and that the way that that's given is through the mechanism of relationship. We're given the opportunity to enter into relationship with Hashem, develop that relationship, develop ourselves through that relationship, create our, make ourselves into a kli to receive Hashem, and through perfecting ourselves, widen the kli that we are, enlarge the kli that we are to receive more Hashem. It's basically the process. So, but the body and soul will receive that together. It's not just a soul thing, but the way it works is that the soul itself will be able to give to the body, and the body will then become rarefied and purified through the gift of the soul. So, in the resurrection, let me just make sure. Just trying to think how far I want to go there. I think we'll leave it there and we'll just go with the next paragraph because it goes into it. I don't want to pre-explain something. But just for the end of this, paragraph 10, is that we will be able to see, it will be apparent how much a person achieved through the rarefication that the body, each particular body, experiences by its reuniting with its soul. So it's not going to be our bodies. When we, when somebody dies, when a person dies and the soul is separated, the soul leaves the body and then the body is left behind. As we know, there's a tahara process. And you might wonder if a dead Jewish body is the height of tumah on the planet, which it is, it's more tameh than a dead non-Jewish body, because if you think of tumah as a potential vacuum, any tahara is really, if you think of tumah and tahara as a continuum, you know, ultimate tahara on one end and ultimate tumah on the other end, so tahara is connectivity to Hashem. The ability to connect with Hashem is with as little impediment as possible. That's what tahara is, basically. And tumah is inability to connect with Hashem. So the least able to connect with Hashem is a dead person, right? There is no potential for connection in somebody who's dead. So then you might think all human beings are the same, right? Once the soul leaves the body, so dead is dead. Dead non-Jew, same as dead Jew, right? So they're both equally tummy. But in fact, they're not, because the tuma reflects the vacuum of the potential. So a Jewish soul has a stronger ability to connect with Hashem in the Tahara range, so that when it dies and the soul leaves the body, it creates a greater vacuum of potential, so that a dead Jewish body is more tamei than a dead non-Jewish body. So now we take the most tamei thing on the planet, a dead Jewish body, and if we have a city that has a mikveh for dead, for bodies, then we dip it in that mikveh. If we don't have a city that has a mikveh, we pour tisha kabim on it. It's prepared. First, the body is washed carefully, and then there's 9 kabim of water, and I'm not sure how much a kav is, but it's basically 5 or 6 buckets of water are poured. I did a tahara once, so I was able to participate in the process, but in the place that I went to didn't have a mikveh, but they did have a table that after we washed the mace, we were able to like tip the table up, strap the mace on sort of and tip the table up, and then we just pour the tisha kabim from head down, sort of like a shower. Okay, so now we've done, that's the tahara, that's dressed in the tachrichim, and then placed in the coffin, and then placed in the ground. So you might think, what is the point of a tahara? How can you be matahir something that is the av hatuma? It's av avi hatuma. There's lots of levels of tuma. Av hatuma is something that makes something else tame, but av avi hatuma is the most tame thing, and that's a dead body. There's nothing you can do to it to make it tahor. But we still do a tahara. So that's because we're planting it in the ground, sort of like a bulb is planted in the fall to see a flower in the spring. So we plant the body in the ground, but we want to plant it ready for Tchias HaMesim. So we want to do a tahara so that the tahara sort of will go into effect at the Tchia. So just like when you plant a tulip bulb, it looks nothing like the flower. If you cut it in half, you can't see a tulip inside it, not even a tiny little one that's going to spring up in the springtime. So you plant the bulb, and it's just a round hulk. Into the ground it goes. It decomposes, and in the spring, up comes a flower that looks nothing like that bulb, and yet is that bulb, but isn't. What is it? It's related to it. It's the same genetic material as it, but it's not it. So that's a mashal for what happens when we plant our bodies. The body gets planted like a bulb, right? And then it goes through decomposition. And then there's Tchias HaMesim. But it's not that your body comes up just like it was planted. You know, so in the Chabad tradition, they talk about it coming up at age 19. Right, so that's a good age. You're nice and strong. You're beautiful. Hopefully you're thin then too, right? So whatever, it's yours. It's a good, strong age where everything's pretty healthy, age 19. But that's just a mashal. It's so important not to take things literally, and it's so important to remind our students not to do that. A lot of times students can get stuck on the literal terms of a mashal. It's important to remind people how a mashal works. It's just meant to be a parable, to bring a concept closer, but not to parallel it perfectly. It's just to help you get a glimpse of something that you haven't been able to experience. So when you say Tchias HaMesim brings up bodies who are age 19, what is meant by that is a different body comes back. It's not the 90-year-old body that was buried with poor eyesight and wrinkly skin, you know, and a broken hip or whatever disease that died of. It's a healthy, strong, fresh, vibrant body, but not the same one that was planted. And particularly not, I mean, especially if we, which we do, believe in reincarnation, so then which body comes up? You know, the one of you that was in 1328, a peasant girl somewhere, or the one of you in 1596 who was worried about the Inquisition finding her in Mexico after she escaped from Spain, or the one of you in, you know, 1950 who was recovering, you know, a survivor from the Holocaust, or the one of you now? Like, which one? which one is it? You know, and to make matters even more complicated, which husband do you get in Triasamesim? So it's not nearly as simplistic as the body just gets up out of the grave and it's the same one that was placed in the grave. That being said, however, there is a relationship of what comes up. And basically, I mean, a way to envision it is not a body getting up out of the grave, not one that you might recognize, but sort of a physical hulk coming up that's in existence. And I don't know exactly what it's going to look like when they, if graves open up or not, who knows. But the point is a physical hulk that is in existence that will be the body of the resurrected person. And then the soul, which we'll see in a few minutes where the soul goes, but then the soul, after its sojourn in the soul world, is dropped back into that body. And when the body and soul are reunited, then the soul is able to use its koach to completely transform that body. And the body will be, that body will be the physical representation of the achievements of the soul. And so then it will be very easy to see where everybody's holding. Now, I'm sure you've heard stories which are only parables of what this means. But I'm sure you've probably heard, let's say, Hasidic tales of two women who make a pact. You know, whichever one dies first should come to the other one in a dream and tell her what it's like on the other side. And so this happens, and one dies, she comes back, and she comes back without a certain limb. In the dream, she appears without a certain limb, without hands or without feet, because she didn't use her feet to run to do mitzvah, or she didn't use her hands in a certain way that was required, or she came back with extra beautiful hands because she did use them a certain way. So those are also all mushals. Not that the story or the dream might not be true. It might be, who knows? But the idea is you don't come back with the same body, and it's not that you might come back without hands. It's because you don't need your hands really after the resurrection, but you do need a body to be able to experience the sublime pleasure of Hashem. It is the channel through which things pass to the soul, but the body itself will actually represent the accomplishments of the soul. It will perfectly reflect it upon reuniting. So it might appear that there, if one, depending on what one developed and what one didn't develop, that will be reflected in the body. So a way to say that in this world's language is a body might be without hands if it didn't do mitzvahs with its hands. But it's not actually the case, because you're not going to have people walking around with holes or partial limbs in Triyat Emetim times, but there will be the accurate reflection of the accomplishments of the soul in the body that the soul wears after the resurrection. Any questions on that so far? Okay. If not, then let's see. Okay, I'm going to leave that. That's the end of 10 for today. And now I want to go to a question that was emailed in. If anybody wants to claim the question for conversation, great. And if not, we can leave it anonymous. Okay, so here's the question. I have a very cerebral intelligence, already been down the Eish/Or Sameach Frum path, now egalitarian, neighbor/friend. She's almost finished with her PhD in ancient Judaism, specifically the history of astronomy in Judaism with excursions in the ancient world. And she loves to talk with me about her strong connections with Hashem and Emunah. That's very strong. Recently, she had a burning issue to discuss, and she carefully confessed that through all of her studies, she still doesn't believe in a literal revelation at Sinai. I am no competition to her extensive philosophical thoughts and readings, and I'm not really equipped to deal with it in terms of answering her. However, she is enjoying Chapter 2 of Beyond a Reasonable Doubt by Rabbi Shmuel Waldman. And she read The Coming Revelation, which, as a scientist in her own right, has some flawed proofs and wasn't scientifically sound enough. She does have a gifted 4.5-year-old daughter to whom she feels responsible to give over a rich and true form of Jewish tradition, and even hopes to influence her in real religious practice. She recently dismissed the conservative responsa to driving on Shabbos, even just to shul, because she believes in halacha and lo tivaru esh, and she believes that equals combustion, which is different than electricity, and tries to institute more Shabbistic things into their Shabbos. But it kills her that she just can't believe in Ma'amad Har Sinai. I'm her only non-modern Orthodox, non-academic friend that she discusses this with. How do I help her? Okay. If I had all the answers, that would be fabulous. But I can discuss this a little bit. So it's not possible to explain to somebody that it's true. That's the real truth. You can try all the permission to believe and permission to receive you want, and all the when would the lie have been perpetrated, that kind of tactic that we learn in Moreshet and Aish and wherever we've been Kiruv trained or whatever reading we've done in our own private self-training. But the truth is, Emunah comes from inside. And even if you want to go with an argument of our fathers wouldn't lie to us, which is a classic argument, and it says, I think, in Dvarim, something like Lo Yishakir Av Levano, that a father wouldn't lie to his son. So, first of all, we all know fathers who have or have heard of fathers who have lied to their children. But apart from that, there are plenty of people who obviously aren't lying to their children and yet are teaching them things that aren't true. Like, let's say, most of the world that teaches Christianity, certainly all of the world that teaches Mormonism, you know, most of the world that teaches Islam, they're teaching things to their children that just aren't true at all. And they don't see themselves as lying. And they've been teaching the same thing for hundreds, if not thousands of years to their offspring. So the fact that my father told me or somebody's father told me and it's true is not really a legitimate argument either. So the question is, how do you build that emunah where you really believe that Hashem revealed himself to the Jewish people and that revelation is contained in the Torah Shebichtav that we have today? That's one of, you know, a few of the principles through a few of the Yud Gimel Yikarim. So really it is a slow process. It's a process of building emunah that can only happen inside the person. And part of it is a desire to achieve that. And I would say particularly in this case where the person is asking to believe it, wants to believe it, but she just can't, where she says it just kills her that she doesn't believe it. She just can't believe in it. So there's a few things here. One is she probably needs to daven to believe in it. That tefillah can actually help you jump levels, and it can help you achieve things that you can't achieve by natural processes. Now, how would you believe that? That's a different question. But that is the case with tefillah, is that it can bring you places that you can't get to on your own, or it can bring you places faster than you could get to on your own. It's interesting.
That's
we can all... Pardon?
It's Johnny. Can I interrupt and ask you?
Yeah.
Does that mean, and I'll claim my question, does that mean that she, you're saying she has to daven for her desire to believe, or she just has to have tefillah?
No.
Like super...
she already desires to believe. She has to daven to believe.
Wow, daven that she should believe in this. I'm saying
yeah.
I'm saying she considers herself a ma'amin, everything else. She puts on tefillin the yechidus because she doesn't want to do it for the wrong reasons ever before Hestia, and she believes that that is because she's a very distractible person. I don't know, what's a PhD, whatever. But she says she's a very distractible person, and she knows that her tefillos can be, you know, that with tefillin on, she's guided, and she's... So I'm saying this is a person that's a super davener, but you're saying she specifically has to daven for the ability to believe in this.
Yes, 100%. She has to be davening for that. And she may be distracting herself. She may be harming herself by putting on tefillin. That's the truth. Because it's very important to understand how halacha works. And a lot of people don't understand that. So halacha, which again is broad, halacha is a broad pathway. It has edges where somebody could be off that path of halacha, but the path of halacha is broad. There's a lot of possibilities within the path of halacha, but halacha means walking. Right, there's all kinds of theory when you're sitting and talking. There's all kinds of theory. Should we do it this way? Should we do it that way? What does it mean this way? What does it mean that way? But when you get up from the table, you have to know how to walk. And that's what halacha is. It's a psak that says, psak means stop, right? Stop thinking and start walking. So halacha is how you walk, the way that you physically engage in the world in order to achieve spiritual connection. That's what halacha is. So if you think you can achieve spiritual halacha, spiritual connection outside of halacha by making up your own halacha or by bastardizing halacha, then you're sorely mistaken. Halacha is the way to engage in this world physically to achieve spiritual connection. So it's very important, if she wants that spiritual connection, to understand what the halacha is and to do it accurately. And that's why we're careful to review and re-review, and I should just say this to myself, review and re-review the Hilchos Shabbos and everything else, like Borer and whatever it is that we could sometimes forget pieces of. It's so important to do it correctly because that is the way you achieve the connection with Hashem, only through building a kli through halacha. Halacha is the kli builder. What you fill that kli with is your relationship with Hashem. But you have to build the kli with halacha. So putting on tefillin, beyichidus, if she's not keeping everything else, let's say, may not be the right place for her to go. That may be a false connection or a sense of, it may in a way, and I'm sure she's not doing it this way, but it may be accessing a strain of gaiva. In her that prevents her tefillos from going where they need to go or prevents a humility that's necessary in tefila if she thinks she gets to pick and choose, you know, where she wants to be in halacha. So that's one. That's a whole serious conversation. That's a separate conversation with her. But let's just go back to how tefila works for a second. So a person can be on a level and they can only see slightly above their level. Not possible to see far above one's level, spiritually or physically. And I had that experience one time when I was taught that, again, in a shiur by Tila Yeager. And then I had the experience of seeing it in action one day when I had a family stay with us for Shabbos, a frum family, and I was walking to shul with the mother, and we were followed behind by our young teenage daughters. And we were walking down the street in Long Beach, Long Island, where there's lots of old turn of the last century falling apart houses, lovely large houses. And so we were just fantasizing which house we wanted. I want that house. No, I want that house. I want that house plus $1 million to fix it up. I want that house plus $1 million to fix it up and full-time help. I want that house plus $1 million to fix it up and three in full-time help. So that's what she said, the other mom. So then her teenage daughter from behind said, oh, no, so I said, three in help? What would you do with three in help? Like, I could understand two in help, right? You need somebody in the house to, like, keep everything clean, maybe even to help you cook, right? And somebody outside the house to keep the grounds, you know. But I was thinking, like, where would she use a third in help? She didn't need a nanny. Like, who would be her third in help? So I said, what three in help do you need? She said, well, I need a driver. I said, really? So then her teenage daughter said, oh, Ma, what would you do with a driver? That way you could do your mending in the back of the car on the way to work? So when her daughter said that, it was very clear to me, this principle that Tila was teaching about, that you can only see a level or two ahead of you, right? This was not a family that had money. I don't think they even had, like, regular cleaning help. Of course, not even full-time live-in cleaning help, but even regular, like, once-a-week cleaning help they probably didn't have. So this young teenage girl couldn't possibly see into a world in which her mother would have full-time three and help a driver. What do you do with that? It's for sure not so you can do your mending in the back of the car on the way to work. Like, that's what she was picturing, because she couldn't see far enough ahead that what wealth might look like. You're not mending your own stuff. So she couldn't see it. So spiritually also, we can't see that far ahead of ourselves. We could only see a level or two. Maybe we've met somebody who's spiritually ahead of us, and we can recognize that, and we could wish for that. But we can't see, okay, even if we would encounter somebody who's way ahead of us, we might see, oh, they're a very spiritual person, they're a very accomplished person, but we wouldn't be able to understand how far ahead of us they are because we don't have the kalim to even perceive it. So tefillah helps us jump up a few rungs. We can skip some rungs through tefillah. That's a way to climb a little faster. So if you want to achieve spiritual heights, you have to daven to achieve them. And you get there faster. You climb higher faster through tefillah. It gets you. It can help you achieve things that you can't even imagine that you want to achieve. It can set your sights higher. So Aleph is, she has to use tefillah. She has to daven for what she wants. I want to believe in this. I want to trust you, Hashem. I want to know your Torah is true. I want to know that you gave it to us. Please, Hashem, help me believe it. Please help me know it. Not just believe it. Please help it become integrated into my consciousness in whatever ways that needs to be, whether it's, you know, and sometimes when I daven to Hashem, I give Hashem suggestions, and I realize I don't need to do that. Hashem's smarter than me. But let me just go with this so you can hear how it might go. Please, Hashem, help this become integrated into my consciousness, whether it's me through me hearing a shiur that I need to hear, or if it's seeing an article on the internet or in person, or whether it's a book that I encounter or a person that I meet, you know, or you're smarter than me, Hashem, you figure it out, but please help me have the experiences I need to have in order to be able to integrate this into my consciousness in a way that it becomes absolute and total knowledge where I never doubt it again. Right, so something like that. She needs to daven for that. That's number one. But number two is she needs to understand, and we all need to understand, that emunah in anything, whether it's emunah in Hashem self, or whether it's an emunah in his Torah or in his Nevi'im, whatever it is, it's built slowly and it's built. It's not something that just slides into place. Now, it may be a series, it is always a series of experiences. It's a process through which one experiences the world and one's intellect catches up. Sometimes one's intellect takes the step and one's experience catches up, but it's always experience and intellect, insight and experience going, walking side by side. They have to catch up with each other, but one may take the step first. But it is a process through which they both have to come into contact with each other and with the world. So where you get greater understandings, let's say you read something, and then that changes your perspective, and then your eyes see slightly differently, and then all of a sudden you see something that you never saw before, right? And that solidifies what you just read. Or you see something that you totally didn't get, but you do understand that that's slightly different than you thought, and then that Shabbos, you hear a shiur that helps you put what you saw into perspective. And it's just it's like cogs in a wheel of just click, 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 click. They build from wonder into belief, into knowledge, into absolutely integrated into the core of your being. Slowly, slowly, slowly. And level by level by level. It's not something that you can get all at once. It's not something that a discovery weekend can give you or a whole week of Arachim. But it is something that one can set their mind to accomplish over time, and it will come over time. So, and for those people who don't set their mind to accomplish it, let's say our children, right? So it is something that we can slowly attempt to build into them by offering experiences and education. But in the end, they have to also make it theirs by desiring it for it to be theirs, and slowly work with that process of experience and intellect, experience, prayer, intellect, step by step by step. It builds inside a person. So I think somebody who is feeling a lack in emunah, whether it's one of us or one of our students, needs to understand that it's something that can grow. And then it's something also that waxes and wanes, because it's something that, in a way, is experienced through the body. Body and soul do go together. They're not diametrically opposed. So there are times when the body influences how the soul perceives and feels. So sometimes it could just be hormonal or chemical. There could be depression. There could be hormonal things, with whether it's monthly hormonal things or nursing or pregnancy or whatever it is, other stresses in the world that can that can strain emuna or that could strengthen emuna, could make somebody sharper also and able to perceive it better. But people can go through dry spells of emuna because of bodily things. So that's important to understand also. Third that I want to point out is what we put into our minds. So it's very important for her to understand what she's put into her brain. All the explorations that she's done through secular sources have put some level of tarfus into her brain. One of my grandmother's favorite expressions as I would sit as a child and read comic books was, "Don't put rocks in your egg basket." And it bothered her very much that I would read things that were silly and put those silly things into a mind that should be holding tachlis. So, and that was her expression. She would tell me what it was like, a little girl going out to gather the eggs, and she saw shiny rocks and said she picked up the rocks and put them in her basket. And by the time she got to the hen house, there was no room left over for the eggs that she was supposed to bring home. And that's what reading comics is. But it's not just reading comics. That's what some university research is, too. And that's what some novels are, too. And that's what some movies are, too. And that's what some conversations are, too. And that's what some other types of explorations are, too. So when people take a time for a long journey of exploration into areas that are not healthy for building Jewish souls, they can end up with a, not, it's obviously, it's not rocks in their, it is sort of rocks in their egg basket. It's not that there's limited space, but there's limited ability to pay attention. So even though our brains can hold a ton, when we put, whether it's narishkeit or incorrect information into our brains, we can expect to have to contend with that. And that can pull us away from positive thoughts and places where we need to be developing and growing. So one needs to be very careful with what they put into their minds and who they learn from and what they read. So I think, you know, there's a case to be made for proactive care in that also. Is that you that just rejoined, Shani? Just checking.
Yes.
Okay, so you missed that explanation, but you can go back and listen to it. But do you have any questions, even having missed part of the last piece? Wait, it's very hard to understand you. You're very choppy. Not really. Oh, that's better, I think. Try it again.
Okay, I'm going to call you separately.
Oh, I think, okay, you can call me separately. That's fine. Okay, good.
Okay,
so
thank you so much, Liz. I appreciate
sure.
it.
Okay, sure. We'll talk later.
Okay, thank
great.
You. So, take care.
Okay, all right. Well. Okay, so I think that's it for tonight. That answers that question. Unless somebody else has another question that you want me to address tonight. Anybody have any other questions?
It's Sarah. I have a quick question, not really. I just need advice.
Okay.
Hopefully quick. A guy in our
community. It can be a long question. I just wanted to leave space for that.
Okay. No.
Okay.
A guy in our community who is, you know, is on a journey, is dating a girl who's Shomer Shabbos. He's still an Ishes Ish. He does not have not a civil divorce and not a get yet. Do I have a responsibility to let the woman know?
Let's see. The guy is dating her. He's Shomer Shabbos.
He is not.
He's not Shomer Shabbos.
He
is Shomer Shabbos. She is an Ashes Ish.
No, he is. Well, he's in whatever.
He's married.
He's still legally and halachically married.
Right.
He's separated.
So do you have a responsibility to let her know? Have you spoken to him yet?
Yes. Meaning I haven't brought up this point that it's come up in other conversations with other women that he's dating, he knows, you know, this is who I am, this is what I'm doing. Now, with women who are not from, this hasn't come up yet because none of the other women that he did. And in his mind, I want to start a relationship because I've had a conversation. I want to start a relationship so that when I get my get, I can just take it to the next level.
Mm-hmm. When he gives his get.
Right. Or, well, ready to give it. She's, at this point, holding back.
She's holding back.
Correct. Meaning he would give it yesterday if it was up to him.
So I think probably he should be advised, and this is a halachic question, but I have encountered this just experientially before. He should probably, I mean, with the, you know, consult a rabbi, but probably he should give a get to a beis din.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been done. And she should just be told that the get has been delivered to the beis din, and she's free to come get it whenever she wants. That being said, he's still not divorced until she picks it up. But
right.
He then is able to, with a clear conscience, tell somebody, I'm technically still married, but I gave my get to a beis din, and I'm waiting for her to pick it up. Now, if he's already done that for a while, I did know somebody that this happened to where the woman is really trying to torture the man by not taking the get. That's where a heter mea rabbanim comes in, where he, where it's possible in the case of torture by the woman that he can go to 100 rabbis on 3 continents and get their signatures that he's done it correctly, and then he's permitted to take a second wife.
Right. So I'm aware of heter mea rabbanim. I don't think, I mean, Bezat Hashem, we're not going to get there. Because hopefully whatever conditions she's putting in the way are not unsurmountable.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
She's not, from, you know, I mean, it's a family we're involved in, and we know both sides.
Mm-hmm.
So she's not at this point withholding it. I mean, she doesn't want to be generous and nice, and she wants certain deals out of the divorce.
Mm-hmm. So she's using it as leverage.
Correct, and she wants to hang it as long as she can
mm-hmm.
to get everything she feels and her revenge of it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think
but
it's important.
But it's not.
I don't think you need to tell
you
them.
You know, at that point, she hopefully will, you know, will say, I'm ready to receive it.
Uh-huh. I think it's important to talk to him and say, I see that you're really interested in Stephanie. And, you know, Stephanie is Shomer Shabbos, and and she would want, it would be important to her to know that you don't have a get yet. It doesn't mean, you know, you have mitigating circumstances that I'm aware of. And if she was made aware of them, I'm sure she'd probably be okay with the patience of it. But that is an important point in honesty, is just to tell the person that you're not completely free yet.
Okay.
If he then, after you speak to him or have your husband speak to him, if he refuses or doesn't want to say, and you see it's getting a little bit more serious, then you probably do want to just warn her. Because then it's actually a bigger warning, really, than the warning is.
Right, that's what I was
going
to say. Right, exactly. At that point, then she, exactly.
And it's a much bigger deal than he's just not being, you know, that he's not telling her that. It's that he's not being honest with her.
Right.
Altogether. Then that's a big relationship red flag. But I think
I
think the right way to do it is to talk to him and have him talk to her, not just you go to her.
Right. Okay. Okay. Great. Thank you. I appreciate
sure.
that, because I'm saying it hasn't come up since till now. All the women he was dating, you know, weren't holding on a level that it would concern them.
Mm-hmm.
So
I think a lot of people would be concerned about it, though. I think women want to know. I mean, probably a get doesn't matter, but he's not officially divorced legally either.
No, so I think they knew that he wasn't legally divorced, but to them, some of them may have not been legally divorced either.
Mm-hmm. I mean, he needs to know about gets, too, in case he's dating somebody divorced. He doesn't want to be the father of a mom there or be adulterous.
Right, no, he does. Like I'm saying, from his perspective, mm-hmm. he was, you know, already a few months ago, my husband spoke to, you know, Ribnata Greenblatt, and he was going to calm down. And, but you know, she's just it's in her court at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I should have my husband or me bring it to his attention.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And with a recommendation, not just his attention, but with a
right.
recommendation that he be straight.
Right. Okay. Okay. Great. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Okay, take care. Have a good night.
Okay, all right, be well. Okay, all right, bye-bye. Good night, everybody.